religion as control is a popular idea at the moment. Let me give you a couple of examples of people thinking like this. Just this last New Year's Eve, me and my family went camping. To be out in nature and enjoy the serenity. And we ended up in essentially a parking lot next to all of Western Sydney, a rowdy bunch next to us. And I'm an old codger now, three kids. I may not look it, but I feel old inside. So I'd gone to bed at, 9 p.m. on New Year's Eve, and I was just listening to the conversation of this rowdy bunch that were camped right next to us. And of course, eventually the topic for religion came up, and the group agreed that religion is control. Their perception was that religion is designed to stop people doing the things that they enjoy, that other people don't want them to do. Another example is June 2, a new movie that's just come out in the last few weeks. I went and saw it with a couple of mates, and the main guy in the movie is a messiah figure, a religious guy. And a character in the movie says about him, "You want to control people? Tell them a messiah is coming." So according to this movie, religion controls people and makes them live a certain way in their lives. Another example is just a mate of mine. We met a couple of months ago, and so I let him know I'm a Christian, hoping to strike up a conversation about Jesus. And his response really captures what I think is just so characteristic of so many Aussies. He said, "Oh, that's cool you're a Christian. I'm not. I'm okay if you are. Just don't talk to me about it." So according to him, religion, it's kind of like whatever floats your boat, and it's cool as long as you keep it personal. At its heart, it's a desire that somebody else's religion wouldn't control me. So it's all the same. People fear or don't trust religion because they think it's control. A Good Friday shatters that concern. Good Friday breaks down the idea that religion is some human invention to control people. And it proves that true religion, the true religion of Christianity, is the best possible thing for your life. Now, what even is Good Friday, you might ask? We've been talking about it a lot so far. But Good Friday, to be crystal clear, in the Easter weekend is when Christians around the world remember and celebrate the execution of their God in the person of Jesus on the cross. And I want to make a case that the religion of that Good Friday is the furthest thing from a human invention to control people, and that the reality of Jesus' death is true and good. They're my two points. The first is that the very core of Christianity, Jesus' death on a cross and everything that stems from it, is not made up. It is true. And the second is that the news of Jesus' death on a cross is not a terrible control imposed on people. It's good. It's the best possible news you could ever imagine for your life. Now, to do that, we're going to go through a book of the Bible called Isaiah. It's printed out in your outlines there, so make sure you keep that handy in front of you. It's written about 700 years before the events of Jesus. And there's little numbers before each of the sentences. They're called verses. I'm going to use those to show you where the verse is that we're talking about. Now, the first point is that Jesus' death on a cross and the Christian religion that's built on his death is true. And if it's true, we don't get to decide if it's made up to control people or not. Facts don't care about feelings after all. And not wanting it to be true doesn't change if it is or not. So how do we know it's true? Well, the first piece of evidence comes from that fact that this book, the book of Isaiah, is written about 700 years before Jesus and speaks so clearly about his life and ministry. And I trust you're familiar with parts of Jesus' life at least. But maybe not all of it. And that's why we had that reading from Mark of his death, his trial, his execution, to keep it fresh in our minds. So let's look at Isaiah 53 and see how accurately this prophecy can speak about Jesus 700 years in advance. Have a look halfway through verse 2. It says, "He didn't have an impressive form or majesty that we should look at him. Think of the circumstances that Jesus is born into. He's born in a stable, not a castle. His bed is a food trough for animals, not a fur-lined crib. He looked like a regular guy, probably not like Arnold Schwarzenegger. There's nothing impressive or majestic about Jesus that makes him appealing to people. In fact, people do the opposite. Have a look at verse 3. It says, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering who knew what sickness was." If there's one thing humans did best to Jesus, it was despising and rejecting him. His enemies rejected him, and even his closest friends, his disciples, rejected him at the very end. And he's a man of suffering. And he doesn't just know about suffering and spend his time with suffering people, which he did. He suffered himself. Have a look at verse 5. It says, "But he was pierced because of our transgressions." You can't miss it, can you? This is speaking about Jesus' hands and feet pierced as he's nailed to the cross and executed. And in verse 7, it says, "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he didn't open his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, and like a sheep silent before her shearers, he did not open his mouth." And you might remember from that reading we just had from Lucy that as Jesus is brought to trial, he doesn't defend himself. And when abuse and insult and when he's mocked, he doesn't retaliate with his own words. The man of suffering in Isaiah 53, 700 years before it happened, is Jesus. Now that alone is remarkable. And this isn't the only place in the Old Testament that speaks about Jesus well before his time. Different authors, independent of each other, speak about Jesus in advance. Now, if it really was all just made up by humans, what are the chances of speaking so accurately about a man 700 years in advance? What are the chances that different authors, separated by space and time, wrote about the same man? It'd be like separating us all in the room, telling you to go home and write the plot or the script for a TV show that's coming out in 20 years' time. Now, I'd get us to do it if we had the time, because it'd be funny. It would be funny to see how bad your script writing is, and it would be funny to see how different these scripts would be from each other. It'd be obvious, wouldn't it? If we were just making this stuff up, there's no way we would all be able to accurately tell the same future. Jesus and the facts of his life and death are not made up by humans. They're prophesied or predicted well in advance as God's plan. Now, the other thing to notice is that if you were making all this stuff up to start a religion, this is terrible source material. Like, come on, seriously. If you were making up a religion you knew was fake, surely you would want to make it as appealing and impressive as possible. You would want the figurehead of your religion to be someone that captures people, to be loved and accepted, not despised and rejected. Think about it. If you're a scammer on the internet and you're trying to sell something you know is fake, you don't make up things that suck about the thing you're trying to sell. Like, here's a camera. It doesn't take photos. You'll want to return it, but we don't accept returns. It's $4,000 into this direct transfer bank account. No one is going to go for that, except that's exactly what Isaiah is doing. He's speaking about a man of suffering, despised, not valued by humans, innocent, but executed on a cross. And he's speaking about Jesus in this way because he's not making up. There's more than there appears, but he's not making it up. He's speaking about God's plans for these things to happen to a man of suffering, which Jesus fulfills 700 years later. Jesus' death on a cross, the very core of Christianity, is not made up by humans. It's planned by God, and it's true. Now, you might concede, okay, it's true, fine, but how can it be good? And I want to show you from this passage again that the news of Jesus' death on a cross is not terrible control imposed on people. It's good. It's the best news you could ever imagine for your life. Pick up in your handouts again from verse 4. It says, "Yet he himself bore our sicknesses, and he carried our pains. But we in turn regarded him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. He was pierced because of our transgressions, crushed because of our iniquities. Punishment for our peace was on him, and we are healed by his wounds. We all went astray like sheep. We all have turned to our own way, and the Lord has punished him for the iniquity of us all. This is a passage that's all about Jesus' death on a cross. And it's not just saying that he died on a cross, it's saying why he died on a cross. And it's because of two words we just read there in verse 5. It says, but he was pierced because of our transgressions and crushed because of our iniquities. Transgression and iniquity, they're not words that we use every day, are they? They sound like connoisseur ice cream flavors. What do they mean? Well, they're both legal words. Transgression means violation or an offense, and iniquity means crime or the guilt you feel from committing a crime. Now, I'm guessing most of us don't have a criminal record in this room, most. But the guilt of crime this passage is talking about is not the crime that's established in a human court of law. It's the kind that's established in God's court. Every human is guilty of throwing off God's rule over their lives. That's what verse 6 is saying. If you have a look at it, it says, we all went astray like sheep. We all have turned to our own way. And what does that look like? Going astray, turning to our own way? Well, it can look like apathy towards God, not caring if he's there or not, and just going your own way. It can look like contempt towards God, actively rejecting his authority over your life. And it can even look like ignorance, not knowing God, even though he makes himself so clearly known through creation. Turning away from God and living your life your own way is a terrible, terrible crime with terrible consequences. Because when we turn away from God and reject his rule, we're saying to the very God who made us and gives us life that we don't need or want him, that we don't even care to know who he is. It's like the child who says to loving parents, get out of my life, I don't know you. It's a terrible offense to live our lives turned away from God, because God is more than just a loving parent. He's the God of the universe. And so the punishment for turning away from that God is absolutely terrifying. Death. And not any death, but death as punishment. And even though it's a terrible punishment, it's fair. I'd go so far as even to say it's good. It's fair because of who God is. If we turn away from the eternal God who made everything, who owns every galaxy and every black hole, who created the earth and gave us life and supports and sustains every molecule in our bodies and each breath we take, if we turn away from that God, he has the right to take away our life, to take away our breath and punish us with death. And it's only God's mercy that we don't die immediately, but we can be sure that the punishment of death will eventually come for us all. And the Bible is very clear. It's a punishment that lasts forever in hell, the worst place imaginable, cut off from anything good that God provides. It's right to fear death. But notice, who gets punished here in these verses? Who gets punished for this crime? Have a look again halfway through verse 5. It says, punishment for our peace was on him, and we are healed by his wounds. We all went astray like sheep. We've all turned to our own way, and the Lord has punished him, Jesus, for the iniquity of us all. Jesus takes our punishment so that we don't have to suffer it anymore. When I'm trying to explain this to my kids, I say that Jesus took all our smacks away by taking them on himself. Jesus is like that big sibling, and when we've done something wrong, when we know we're going to get the smack of our life for it, he stands in our place and takes it on himself, the punishment, so that we don't have to. But it's more than that, right? Because God is not just deciding to punish anyone instead of us. Like, I'll give you an example. I got a $400 parking ticket recently, and they sent me a photo of my car illegally parked, except it wasn't my car, it was the wrong number plate. And I rightfully appealed the fine because it's not right to punish me for somebody else's crime. How is it right then that Jesus can be punished for our crimes against God? Well, only if Jesus is God himself, determining to absorb the punishment he holds against humanity in himself. And at great cost to himself, God takes the punishment for our transgressions and iniquities, for our offense and crime of turning away from him. Have you ever realized what a terrible condition we're in as humans who've turned away from the only true God? Inevitable death, sometimes sooner than you'd wish. Death suffered as punishment, an enduring punishment that lasts forever. Have you ever heard better news, that someone has endured this punishment on your behalf? Not anyone suffering on your behalf, but Jesus, God himself, absorbing his own punishment against wayward people who've turned away from him. Has he absorbed your punishment? Because the crazy thing is, it's possible to still despise and reject Jesus, like Isaiah says people do in verse 3. This religion of Jesus' death on the cross is not human control imposed on you. You can still despise and reject Jesus' death on the cross to take away your punishment. You can do that. But why would you? It would mean the punishment of turning away from God remains on your head. And God has made it possible for that punishment to be taken away. If you've turned away from God, or you've never lived your life in recognition of who God is, turn back to him. If you'd like to do that, you need to say sorry to God for living your life turned away from God, whether it's in ignorance or contempt or apathy. You need to trust in Jesus, who suffered God's punishment on your behalf. And you need to turn from living your life away from God to living your life under God's rule. I'm going to invite Troy up now, and he's going to lead us through praying those very things. And if you'd like to chat to Troy or me or anyone on the ministry team after the service, I'd love to sit down with you and have a talk, and maybe even hear if that's the first time you've ever prayed that prayer. Thanks, Troy.